Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am going to do in this audio today 1 Samuel 13, verses 1 through 23. We will entitle this Saul Faces the Philistines at Michmash. Our context is this. In the previous chapter, chapter 12, Samuel gave his farewell address. And then the chapter before that, in chapter 11, Saul had defeated the Ammonites at Jabesh Gilead and thus had established himself as the legitimate king of Israel. So we start now in 1 Samuel 13:1. Saul was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 42 years over Israel. Now this verse has got to be the most difficult verse in the Bible, because of translation problems. Nobody knows when Saul started to reign. Nobody knows when he ended. So let's start with Saul was 30 years old and look at the King James. That's the NASB translation. Let's look at the King James translation. 1 Samuel 13:1, Saul reigned 1 year, not 30. Saul, and not was, but reigned. In other words, it's not Saul was 30 years old, but Saul reigned 1 year. And when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, well, what does that mean? Means nothing to me. The NIV has chapter 13, verse 1 is this. Saul was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned over Israel 42 years. That's exactly like the NASB. But the NIV margin for the number 30 says, quote, a few late manuscripts of the Septuagint say 30 years old and 42 years reigning over Israel. Just a few manuscripts of the Septuagint. Hebrew does not have 30. The Masoretic text doesn't have 30. And then in the marginal note on the number 42, where Saul reigned 42 years over Israel, the NIV note says, see the round number in Acts 13:21. Hebrew does not have 40. So the 30 and the 40 is not even in the Masoretic text. We look at Acts 13:21. Paul says this, and then they asked for a king, and God gave them Saul, the son of Kish, a man of the tribe of Benjamin, for 40 years. I think that's one of Paul's evangelistic sermons. He mentions that Saul had reigned for 40 years. Well, you can see there's so much to reconcile there that I don't know where to begin, so I decided to look at some other translations. Here, let's look at the Holman Christian Study Bible for 1 Samuel 13:1. Saul was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned 42 years over Israel. Well, that's the same as the NASB. The note on the Holman Christian Study Bible says some Septuagint manuscripts omit verse 1. They just leave the whole verse out. But not all of the Septuagint manuscripts do that. Let's look at the ASV, the American Standard Version. 1 Samuel 13:1, Saul was 40 years old when he began to reign, and when he had reigned 2 years over Israel. 40 years old, not 30 years old, and the 40 is in italics, which means it's not in the original manuscript that the ASV was using, which is probably the Masoretic text. And then Saul is said to reign 2 years, not 42 years, but 2 years over Israel. More confusion. How about God's Word translation? 1 Samuel 13:1. Saul was curly brace 30, close curly brace. Saul was 30 in curly braces years old when he became king. He was king of Israel, curly brace, 42, close curly brace years. So the translation is the same as the NASB and the NIV and the Holman Christian Study Bible, but they put curly braces around the numbers. Why? Because they're not in those numbers are not in the original Masoretic text. The marginal note of the Good God's Word translation says this, quote, the text of 1 Samuel 13:1 is problematic in all traditions. Some late Greek manuscripts state Saul was 30 years old when he became king. The ancient Jewish historian Josephus and Acts 13:21 state that Saul ruled for 40 years. Let's look at the NASB notes here for the NASB note on the number 30, which they put in the text without italics or without braces or without anything to show you that it's not in the text. This is what they say about in the note. This 30 is as in some manuscripts of the Septuagint. Hebrew omits 30. It's not in the Hebrew, but some manuscripts put 30 in there, not all. And then the NASB says that as far as the number 40, the Hebrew manuscripts omit that number completely. The Young's literal translation of 1 Samuel 13:1 says, a son of a year is Saul in his reigning. A son of a year is Saul in his reigning. Yea, 2 years he hath reigned over Israel. And what does that mean? The New American Bible in 1 Samuel 13:1 says this, Saul was ... years old. Just leave it blank. They just threw their hands up and said, we're not even going to try. Saul was ... years old when he became king, and he reigned ... parentheses 2 years over Israel. So they say it's basically blank, but we're going to suggest maybe 2 in parentheses. So basically, folks, nobody knows when Saul reigned. Adam Clark says this, a great deal of learned labor has been employed and lost on this verse to reconcile it with propriety and common sense. I shall not recount the meanings put on it. I think this clause belongs to the preceding chapter, either as a part of the whole or a chronological note added afterwards, as if the writer had said, these things, which were related in the previous chapter, took place in the first year of Saul's reign, and then he proceeds in the next place to tell us what took place in the second year. So Clark is going along with the KJV translation there. The second year, those 2 years being the most remarkable years of Saul's reign. In the first year, he is appointed, anointed, and twice confirmed, i.e. at Mizpah and Gilgal, Ramah, Mizpah, and Gilgal. In the second, Israel is brought into the lowest state of degradation by the Philistines. Saul acts unconstitutionally and is rejected from being king. These things were worthy of an especial chronological note. To be honest with you, even though I'm totally confused about this verse, what Clark says makes a lot of sense, especially if you take the past tense reigned and take it as a past perfect. In 1 Samuel 13:1, Saul had reigned 1 year when all that previous stuff happened in chapter 12. And when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, all this other stuff that happens in chapter 13 is going to happen. That makes a lot of sense. But again, that's so controversial, we're never going to sort that one out. I looked at some sources as to when Saul might have reigned. I found one from 1020 to 1000, from 1020 to 1000 BC. John Bright, biography.com, has Saul beginning to reign at 1020, the same as John Bright, but then the BibleHub.com timeline has him started to reign at 1043 and going all the way down to 1010. And then the Church of Christ website, Bible.ca, has him ruling from 1052 to 1025. Well, this is my favorite date of all, Wikipedia, late 11th century BC. They don't even get into it. All right, so enough of that. 1 Samuel 13:2. Now, Saul chose for himself 3,000 men of Israel, of which 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash and in the hill country of Bethel, while 1,000 were with Jonathan at Gibeah of Benjamin. But he, that Saul, sent away the rest of the people, each to his tent. Now, Saul is positioning 3,000 men of Israel. Remember, he had taken 300,000 to fight the Ammonites, and now he's just dealing with 3,000, a lot smaller. Because they were so much smaller, they could have been a personal bodyguard, as Jameson, Foster, and Brown suggest, or maybe just a standing army to protect Israel, like garrisons, if you will. He probably put out some garrisons to be on guard against the Philistines, not to attack them, but just to watch out for them. Now, where did he put them? Well, first of all, he sent 1,000 to Gibeah, Saul's hometown. If you look at Jerusalem, a couple miles north of Jerusalem is Gibeah. If you go straight up from Gibeah, about 6 or 7, 8 miles or so, you hit Bethel. All right, if you look at that as the base of a triangle, which is basically an equilateral triangle with the apex pointing to the east, and you go about 4 or 5 miles up each of the legs, you hit Michmash. So let's look at that triangle, keep that in mind. 2,000 ended up at Bethel and Michmash. It doesn't say how they were divided. I'm going to assume 1,000 equally, just for the sake of keeping the numbers even. So we got 1,000 at Bethel, 1,000 at Gibeah, and 1,000 at Michmash, making a nice little triangle there, again, to protect from the Philistines coming from the west, coming from the north, coming from the south. So he demobilized his army that he had collected to fight Nahash the Ammonite 2 chapters ago. They were at Gilgal. He sends them all home, each to his tent, except for those 3,000 soldiers. Now let's look a little closer at Michmash. As I said, it's at the apex of that triangle, Gilead, Gibeah, on the southern base of the triangle. At the northern base of the triangle is Bethel. Both of these are on a straight line north of Jerusalem. And then to the east, the apex of that triangle is Michmash. You'll see if you look at the map, there's a valley between Michmash and Geba. Geba is the place we talked about a couple of chapters ago when the singing prophets came down, as Samuel predicted they would. This was to convince Saul that, yes, he was indeed chosen to be king because Samuel knows how to prophesy. So the singing prophets came down and Saul started prophesying with them. You remember that story? Geba means Hill of Benjamin. Now, this is now occupied by Philistines, and Michmash is right across the valley to the north, across a valley from Geba, within shouting distance of those two places, are of each other. And so we have the field set. As a little bit of a foreview, let's see what Easton says about Michmash. Michmash means something hidden. Jameson Foster Brown says Michmash means hidden treasure. Easton just says something hidden. So let's just say hidden. It was a town of Benjamin, east of Bethel, on the road to Jerusalem. Well, it's kind of off the road to Jerusalem, that north-south road. It's off to the east a little bit. On the opposite side of the ravine, this is going to the south, is the modern representative of Geba. It's Geba. And behind this again are Ramah and Gilead as you keep going, and Gibeah as you keep going south. Ramah is actually to the west, and Gibeah is a little bit to the southwest. This was the scene of a great battle fought between the army of Saul and the Philistines, which we're getting ready to read about, actually probably next chapter. The Philistines were utterly routed and pursued for some 16 miles towards Philistia, as far as the valley of Ajalon, that's to the west. The freedom of Benjamin secured at Michmash led through long years of conflict to the freedom of all its kindred tribes. In other words, this is the beginning of liberation for Benjamin and later Israel. The power of Benjamin and its king now steadily increased. A new spirit and a new hope were now at work in Israel. Adam Clark says about this division into three companies of 1,000 each, he, that Saul, thought best to divide them into companies and send one against the Philistine garrison at Michmash. We got to remember that the Philistines are at Michmash, and so at Michmash is Saul's garrison, obviously camped in a different place, but they're facing each other, close to each other. There was another garrison at Bethel and a third at Gibeah. Saul perhaps hoped by surprising these garrisons to get swords and spears for his men, of which we find in verse 22 of this chapter they were entirely destitute. Well, that's another possibility is why he sent the soldiers out to get weapons, or it could just be for defensive purposes as a garrison. Clark is assuming there's a Philistine garrison at Bethel and one at Gibeah also, and I think that's probably reasonable, actually. But at any rate, that's where he puts his troops. Bethel to the north, Gibeah to the south, and into the east. In the middle of those two is Michmash. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says it seems to have been his, Saul's, tactics to attack the Philistine garrisons in the country by different detachments, rather than by risking a general engagement, and his first operations were directed to rid his native territory of Benjamin of these enemies. That sounds reasonable. Notice that the Jonathan, who is in charge of the 1,000 troops at Gibeah, that's Saul's famous son, Jonathan, David's good friend. We'll talk about him a lot in the future. The rest of the army, the one that had fought against Nahash the Ammonite two chapters ago, just recently, Saul sends away from Gilgal, and this is the Gilgal where probably the Gilgal that Joshua approached, landed in as soon as he crossed the Jordan River for the first time, and where Joshua had set up the tabernacle for the first time. So that's probably where Saul is now. He sends the army home. We go now to verses 3 and 4. And Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba, and the Philistines heard of it. Then Saul blew the trumpet throughout the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear." And all Israel heard the news that Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines, and also that Israel had become odious to the Philistines. The people were then summoned to Saul at Gilgal. Well, the reason that Israel had become odious to the Philistines is because Jonathan had attacked the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba. A garrison, remember, is a contingent of troops that's left behind in a city to look out, to keep the city, to stop internal revolutions and civil unrest, and also to stop the opposing army from coming back and taking the city again after it had already been taken the first time. So that's what a garrison is. And so the Philistines had a garrison at Geba. Remember, Geba is north of Gibeah, south of Michmash, right? South of the valley that separates Michmash from Geba. And that's why the Philistines were feeling that the Israelites were odious, because they had been attacked. So this is sort of a preemptive attack. It was done by the order of Saul, of course. In fact, we see in verse 4, all Israel heard the news that Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines. So Jonathan, acting for Saul, smote the Philistine garrison at Geba. Now, was this wise? John Gill asks, is this wise to attack Philistines after having just demobilized the army at Shiloh? And what if these garrisons that are held there by the Philistines, what if they were put there by agreement with the Philistines? Well, that's just speculation. In fact, I don't think they were put there by agreement, because the Israelites had just beaten the Philistines at Mizpah, if you remember, a couple chapters ago. And so I suspect there would not be any Philistine garrisons there after that battle, but apparently they had come back, moved back into the land as things had gotten worse and worse, especially after the Israelites had to take care of the Ammonites on the east side of the Jordan, leaving the area to the Philistines. So they're back in town, And you could say, well, this wisdom or not, well, the events turned out such that Saul won the Battle of Michmash. So, yeah, it was wise. You can always say, hey, if it turns out it was wise. That's like saying, was Lee wise to divide his troops at Chancellorsville? Well, if he'd have lost, it would have been the dumbest move in history, but he won. Therefore, he's a military genius. And is that Battle of Chancellorsville is still studied in the military academies. So, again, a lot of times it's how do things work out as to whether it's wise or not. Now, Jonathan took the garrison at Geba by surprise, apparently. We especially think that because there were no weapons available to Jonathan to take the place by storm. We'll see that in verse 22 of chapter 13, our chapter here. And so on the day of battle, neither sword nor spear could be found in the possession of any of the soldiers with Saul or Jonathan. The reason for that is because the Philistines had said, no more blacksmiths in Israel because we're scared you might make weapons to fight against us. And so they had oppressed the Israelites and made all the blacksmiths, swordsmiths, leave Israel and go to the land of the Philistines. Well, once Jonathan had attacked Geba, Saul knew that the Philistines were going to hear about it, which they did, and they were going to come after him. So he blew a trumpet throughout the land, saying, let the Hebrews hear. Trumpet's a very common way of calling troops to battle. Jameson Foster Brown says this about that, quote, a well-known sound, the trumpet, was the usual Hebrew war summons. The first blast was answered by the beacon fire in the neighboring places. A second blast was blown, then answered by a fire in a more distant locality, whence the proclamation was speedily diffused over the whole country. I'm not exactly sure what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown mean there, but basically the way they spread news back then is one signal fire would be lit, and then another sentry post would see that signal fire, and so then they'd light their fire. And then another sentry post that was within sight of the second fire would light their fire, and pretty soon there's fires all over Israel, and everybody knows, getting ready for war, come on down. So the Israelites are getting ready for war. Now in 1 Samuel 13, verses 5 through 7, we read this. The Philistines also assembled for battle with 3,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and foot soldiers as numerous as the sands of the seashore. Moving up against Israel, they encamped in Michmash, east of Bethaven. Some Israelites, aware of the danger and of the difficult situation, hid themselves in caves and thickets among rocks and caverns and in cisterns. And other Hebrews passed over the Jordan into the land of Gad and Gilead. Well, East Jordan is Manasseh to the east on the north side, and then Gad is in the middle on the east side of the Jordan, and Reuben is on the south as you're going down toward the Dead Sea. So the Gad is right across from Benjamin here, so that makes sense that they would go there. Gilead is just the term for the whole area over there. Gad is the particular tribe. So the Israelites are in bad trouble here. They're hiding and they're running. Saul, however, held out at Gilgal, although all his followers were seized with fear, and for good reason. Things are not looking good, especially because of the numbers here. Foot soldiers as numerous as the sands of the seashore were encamped at Michmash. Why did so many Philistines come? Well, they saw that the Israelites were about to try to cast off their yoke, their slavery. Because after the Philistines lost at Mizpah, the Philistines started winning again. And pretty soon they had dominated the Israelites, and now it looks like they were getting ready to revolt again. Now, let's get into the weeds a little bit about these numbers. The Philistines assembled with 3,000 chariots. The New American Bible has... The New American Standard Bible has 30,000 chariots. The Holman Christian Study Bible has 3,000 chariots. Well, first of all, let's forget 30,000. There's no way that there were 30,000 chariots. I don't think the whole land of Israel could hold 30,000 chariots. The Holman Christian Study Bible note here says that one Septuagint manuscript has 3,000. And so does the Syriac translation have 3,000. The Masoretic text, the Hebrew version, has 30,000. But there's no way. So how do we solve this problem? Well, let's just assume it's 3,000. We still got a problem. That's a lot of chariots. Too many chariots. This idea is suggested by Gill, Clark, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown that the word chariot should be translated charioteers. So the Philistines assemble for battle with 3,000 charioteers, and that's reasonable. One, two, or three of these commentators, I forgot which, how many, quote 2 Samuel 10:18. And 1 Chronicles 19:18 to show that the Hebrew word there is translated as charioteers. 2 Samuel 10:18, but the Arameans fled before Israel, and David killed 700 charioteers. 1 Chronicles 19:18, and the Arameans fled before Israel, and David killed of the Arameans 7,000 charioteers. Unfortunately, the numbers, again, those difficult numbers are different there. 700, 7,000, I don't know why. Might be a textual problem. Doesn't really matter. The point is, the word is translated as charioteer. So that makes sense. 3,000 charioteers are fighting 6,000 horsemen, that's cavalry, and foot soldiers that are so numerous they couldn't count them, like the sands of the seashore. John Gill has the chariots all the way down to 300. I don't know how he got there. Let's look at that number again for 30,000. It could be, the way to solve it, as I said, is translated as charioteers, but it also, it could be that the word chariot might include other carriages that weren't chariots, such as carriages to carry baggage. So then it would be 3,000 wheeled vehicles, perhaps. Another option is just a simple manuscript area. The copyist wrote 30 instead of 3, which should have been 3. The Arabic and the Syriac versions have 3,000, not 30,000. Now, why is even 3,000 too big a number so you can't just rely on a copyist error to solve the problem? Because Pharaoh at the Exodus only had 600, and he was the king of Egypt. Exodus 14:7, and he, Pharaoh, took 600 select chariots. Jabin of Canaan, who was, of course, fighting Deborah and Barak, he only had 900. Judges 4:3, and the sons of Israel cried to the Lord for, he, Jabin, had 900 iron chariots. Solomon later had 1,400 chariots, and some of those were just for show. And Darius and his great army against the Greeks at the Battle of Marathon. So just from ancient history, we see that that number 30,000 or 3,000 has got to be explained. Now, where it says that the number of Philistines at Michmash were as of the sands of the seashore, remember, Saul had only sent 1,000 troops there before. So he didn't have a lot of people there ready for battle at Michmash. And of course, he's planning on coming to reinforce them with the army at Gilgal, but he hasn't gotten there yet, and everybody's scared to death. And another thing that makes all the army that's still at Gilgal, to the east there, why are they still scared so much? Well, Samuel, their great prophet, he's not there. In fact, Saul has been waiting on him for seven days. He's not there yet. So the people got a king that's lollygagging around for 7 days, and their prophet's not there, and the Philistines are outnumbering them by bokus of troops. The Hebrews are hiding in the hills and the rocks and the cisterns. Things are not looking good. And isn't that a perfect description of life when things do not look good all the time? So we go now to verse 8 in 1 Samuel 13. Now he, that Saul, waited 7 days according to the appointed time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him, scattering from Saul. Now when did Samuel appoint this time for Saul to wait for him at Gilgal for 7 days? Well, it's not really clear. It could have been at Saul's inauguration at Gilgal. That was the third time he was proclaimed king. 1 Samuel 10:8. Samuel tells Saul, and you shall go down before me to Gilgal, and behold, I will come down to you to offer burnt offerings and sacrifice peace offerings. You shall wait 7 days until I come to you and show you what you should do. Well, I don't think that's it, because the inauguration at Gilgal, the inauguration of Saul as king at Gilgal, had nothing to do with this current war situation. So Adam Clark speculates this is just a different time that Samuel told Saul, wait for me 7 days. It just happens to be the same number of days. Josephus says that Samuel had given Saul standing instructions to wait 7 days. Every time I meet you at Gilgal, I want you to wait for me 7 days. Whenever there's a public meeting down there, give me time to get down there. Now, Samuel didn't come. Was it because he just had a hard time getting down there? Well, some people speculate that he held out in order to test Saul to see if he would trust in Samuel's prophetic word. Would he trust in the word of the Lord? I don't know. Could be. Now, Samuel actually did come at the end of the seventh day. It says right here in verse 8, Samuel did not come. What he means is he did not come until the very last moment of the seventh day, and the soldiers were starting to desert and go home. We read now 1 Samuel 13, verses 9 through 13. So Saul said, bring to me the burnt offering and the peace offerings. And he offered the burnt offering. As soon as he finished offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him and to greet him. So Saul didn't finish his peace offerings. He got interrupted in the middle by Samuel's arrival. But Samuel said, what have you done? And Saul said, because I saw that the people were scattering from me and that you did not come within the appointed days. Notice how it looks like he's sort of throwing the blame off on Samuel. You didn't come, Samuel, and I saw that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash. Therefore, I said, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not asked the favor of the Lord. Now he's acting real pious and holy. I needed to pray about it, brother. So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering. It was hard. I didn't really want to do it. I didn't want to violate your word, Samuel, but I just pushed myself to do it because I had to. Samuel said to Saul, you have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God. which he commanded you, for now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. All right, this burnt offering that Saul offered, it was either by himself that he offered it, or maybe he used a priest. Now we're going to see a difference of opinion in the commentators as to whether he should have done this or not. John Gill said that, and the argument being Saul was not a priest, so he's taking over the priestly function, and that is a violation of the Constitution of Israel, where you have prophet, priest, and king separated out. But John Gill doesn't like that idea. He says this, quote, "In this unsettled time, while the tabernacle, altar, and ark were at different places and not yet fixed, it is thought that such who were not priests might offer, and that in high places and where the tabernacle and altar were not." In other words, we're going to forgive this breach of the law here because of necessity, basically, John Gill is saying. The ark, remember, was at Kiriath-Jearim. The tabernacle and altar were probably still up at Shiloh, but we don't know. A lot of people say it was destroyed. Who knows? But they weren't there at Gilgal. Although some people say that because the people were praying before the Lord that the ark had been brought to Gilgal. I don't believe so. I don't think so. But at any rate, Saul was not a priest, and he offered a burnt offering. Now, after he finished the burnt offering, he stopped before he did the peace offerings when Samuel showed up. Maybe Saul knew that he had done something wrong and knew he had some explaining to do, like Ricardo. Maybe he just wanted to show respect to Samuel. I don't know, but he quit his sacrifices and went to see Samuel. Now, in verse 11, Samuel said, "What have you done?" Well, the question arises, how did Samuel know that the sacrifices had already been done? Well, that's easy. Somebody could have told him. Samuel could have looked at Saul's face and said, "Ooh, he looks guilty." Maybe Samuel had a prophecy. I don't believe so. I think somebody told him. That wouldn't be a secret. In verse 12, as I said, Saul tells Samuel, "Oh, well, I forced myself because of the bad circumstances here. I didn't really want to do it, but I had to do it," looking for a rationale to ameliorate his wrongdoing, his foolishness. Now, Samuel says that Saul acted foolishly in verse 13, but on the surface, it doesn't seem really that Saul acted all that foolishly. His men were deserting him. He wanted to show devotion to God before he went into battle. Well, okay, I'll give Saul that. He was sincere, but he was rash. He didn't do what God had told him to do. And when he got that word from Samuel previously, whenever it was, that was a word from God. That wasn't just a word from Samuel. It was a word from a prophet, a well-respected, well-known prophet who always spoke the word of God and who never missed. And Saul just did it himself. So the moral of this story is it's better to obey God unquestioningly rather than to compromise. Compromise cost, and usually it cost a whole lot. Now, he acted foolishly. John Gill says, well, but he might have acted foolishly, but it wasn't because he took the priestly office on him. He acted foolishly because he ran ahead of Samuel's time limits. I don't think Gill's right about this. I like what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown and Clark say. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says this, quote, "Saul was more ambitious of gaining the glory of a triumph to himself than ascribing it to God." Gill responds and says, no, it was unsettled times. And besides, here's an argument from Silence, John Gill gives, Saul is never charged with usurping the priest office. That's true. It's a speculation, but it's a reasonable one, I think. So let's give you some more quotes from Clark and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown saying that Saul overstepped his bounds and sinned by taking on the role of a priest. Here's Clark, quote, "He, Saul, became impatient, took the whole business into his own hand, and acted the parts of prophet, priest, and king. And thus he attempted a most essential change in the Israelitish constitution. In it, the king, the prophet, and the priest are in their nature perfectly distinct." And here's Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, quote, "Saul, though patriotic enough in his own way, was more ambitious of gaining the glory of a triumph to himself than ascribing it to God. He did not understand his proper position as king of Israel, and although aware of the restrictions under which he held the sovereignty, he wished to rule as an autocrat, who possessed absolute power both in civil and sacred things. This occasion was his first trial. Samuel waited till the last day of the seven in order to put the constitutional character of the king to the test. And as Saul, in his impatient and passionate haste, knowingly transgressed by invading the priest's office and thus showing his unfitness for his high office, as he showed nothing of the faith of Gideon and other Hebrew generals, he incurred a threat of the rejection which his subsequent waywardness confirmed." So Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown think that Samuel deliberately tested Saul, and Saul failed the test. I think they have the better end of the argument. Now, Saul says this breach of God's command to Saul pretty serious because he said the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever, but now he's not going to do that. And we'll see here shortly in the next verse, because David is going to take over. The tribe of Judah is going to take over from the tribe of Benjamin. David the Judahite is going to take over from Saul the Benjaminite. We go now to 1 Samuel chapter 13, verse 14. Samuel continues chewing out Saul. But now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. Now this phrase, a man after his own heart, of course, is a very famous phrase describing David. And of course, the first thing we think is, well, wait a minute. He killed somebody, Uriah, and he committed adultery with Uriah's wife, Bathsheba. What do you mean he's a man after God's own heart? This is talking about David's public life as king. Not talking about his private life. God's not too happy with that. And in fact, concerning David's private life, that phrase is never used, a man after his own heart. That phrase in the scripture is only used to refer to David's public life. Here's what Clark says, quote, in his strict attention to the law and worship of God. David was a man after his own heart, after God's own heart. In David's admitting in the whole of his conduct that God was king in Israel and that he himself was but his vice regent. Because of that, David was a man after God's own heart. Third example, David is a man after God's own heart and never attempting to alter any of those laws or in the least change the Israelitish constitution. And the fourth way that David was a man after God's own heart is that in all his public official conduct, he, David, acted according to the divine mind and fulfilled the will of his maker. Thus was he a man after God's own heart. That's Adam Clark, who says that very well, I think. We go now to 1 Samuel 13, verses 15 through 18. Then Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin, and Saul numbered the people who were present with him, about 600 men. Now Saul and his son Jonathan and the people who were present with them were staying at Geba of Benjamin while the Philistines camped at Michmash. Just basically here, Samuel goes to Gibeah, which is south and west of Michmash, Saul's hometown. He's going to wait the outcome of the battle, see what happens. Saul and his son Jonathan went to Geba, which is right within a stone's throw of Michmash, south of the valley that separates Michmash and Geba. And the reason Jonathan has moved there from Gibeah in the south, Saul's hometown, the reason Jonathan is no longer in Gibeah is because he's attacked, if you recall. He's attacked Geba and driven out the garrison there. So the Philistines are no longer in Geba. They're across the valley at Michmash. Saul goes up to meet his son at Geba. Verse 17, and the raiders came from the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned toward Ophrah, to the land of Shual, and another company turned toward Beth Horon, and another company turned toward the border which overlooks the valley of Zeboim toward the wilderness. Verse 15, Samuel heads to Gibeah, John Gill says, seemingly in wrath and displeasure. Samuel left. Well, I'm sure he was upset, but he didn't want to forsake Saul entirely. Gibeah is a logical place to go. It was Saul's hometown. It was a logical place to get reinforcements in case they were needed. And plus, you can find out what's going on there. So he goes to Gibeah. Now, notice that Saul only brought 600 men up from Gilgal. That's not very many. He's already had 1,000. He had 1,000 established at Michmash around the area. And now Geba, which is in the general area, there was 1,000 that he had sent under Jonathan. Well, he had 1,000 with Jonathan at Gibeah, and Jonathan had moved those 1,000 up to Michmash. So that's 2,000. And then Saul carried another 600 men. Well, 2,600 compared to Philistine soldiers who were as numerous as the sands of the seashore. The good guys are outnumbered big time. Now, in verse 17, we see some foraging expeditions. I don't know if you call it foraging or ravaging expeditions of the Benjaminites, of the Philistines, excuse me, who were ravaging the land of Benjamin. First of all, they went north toward Ophrah, and then they went west toward Beth Horon, and then they went east toward the valley of Zeboim, which is the valley of hyenas. I'm going to tell you where all that is in a minute, but that's basically north, west, and east. They went out all through the land of Benjamin, raping, killing, stealing, pillaging, and so forth, burning. But they didn't go south, because south was where Geba was, and Geba had Saul and Jonathan there. Now notice all this ravaging and spoiling against the undefended land. North and Ophrah, west and Beth Horon, and east and Zeboim. That was what the Israelites had wanted a king to defend against, that very sort of thing, and yet it was still happening even with their king. Why were the Philistines so aggressive here? Well, They had been attacked at Geba by Jonathan, if you recall. And they also realized the Israelites weren't exactly going to stand and fight with a big army, 1,600 people. The rest of the Israelites hiding in caves and cisterns and amongst the rocks. So the Philistines were feeling pretty chippy here, and they're marching all over the place. Now let's look at the map real quick. Michmash and Geba is where we are now. If you go maybe 6 or 7 miles straight north, you hit Ophrah, the valley of Shual. The land of Shual is said to be somewhere around Ophrah. Otherwise, it's unknown, according to BibleAtlas.org. And Ophrah's on the map here. Ophrah means a fawn. The land of Shual means land of the fox. A fawn in the land of the fox. That's to the north. And to the west is Beth Horon. That's a famous place. Remember, it's basically Lower Beth Horon and Upper Beth Horon. Lower Beth Horon being to the north, Beth Horon, Upper Beth Horon to the south. That was a valley that got you out of the hills of Ephraim into the plain, into the Shephelah, into the plain of the Philistines. Joshua had gone through there in his southern campaign. First stop on the way down south was Ajalon, where he made the sun and the moon stand still. So that's to the west. Then the valley of Zeboim, if you will look at the map, if you will go north from Geba to Ophrah, 5-6 miles or so, and then go due west about 8 miles, due east toward the Jordan River. And right when you get out of the hills, you go down into the Valley of Achor. And the Valley of Achor is the same place as the Valley of Zeboim. Zeboim means hyenas, the Valley of the Hyenas. Achor, remember, was the guy who hid after the Battle of Ai, had hid the spoil that he wasn't supposed to because it was devoted to God. He'd hid it under his tent. And he got killed for it, killed right there in the Valley of Achor. Achor was the guy that did that. But it's also called the Valley of Zeboim. That's according to BibleAtlas.org. But anyway, that's interesting geography. But the whole point is north, east, and west, the Philistines are ravaging the land. But the south, Saul and his son Benjamin are holding the fort against further southern encroachments. We go now to 1 Samuel 13, verses 19 through 22. No blacksmith could be found in all the land of Israel, because the Philistines had said, "Otherwise the Hebrews will make swords or spears." So all the Israelites went to the Philistines to sharpen their plows, mattocks, axes, and sickles. The price was 2/3 of a shekel for plows and mattocks, and 1/3 of a shekel for pitchforks and axes, and for putting a point on an ox goad. So on the day of battle not a sword or spear could be found in the hand of any of the troops who were with Saul and Jonathan. Only Saul and his son Jonathan had weapons. So now we see that at Geba, Jonathan and Saul not only were handicapped by being outnumbered big time, they also were out-armored. Also, they didn't have swords. Now, what had happened when the Philistines had gotten their superiority over the Israelites to keep the Israelites from rebelling, they kicked all the blacksmiths out of Israel and sent them into the land of the Philistines. And then they said, "Okay, Hebrews, you need your agricultural implements. You can get them, but you're going to have to come here to get it done." That's kind of an interesting little detail, and I have no idea why the author of 1 Samuel put it in here. I mean, we're down to the pricing of how much it cost. I don't know why such details, but it is interesting. The word there, the Philistines would sharpen the Israelites' plows. The NASB has plowshare. That's the cutting part of the moldboard of a plow. If you think about a plow, it's got that curved piece of metal that comes up, and the dirt goes up under that curved piece of metal and comes out in a circle, kind of. Well, the bottom part of that is a sharp part that cuts the ground, I think. Dictionary.com says a moldboard is the curved metal plate in a plow that turns over the earth from the furrow, so that it has to be sharpened. A mattock is an instrument for loosening the soil and digging, according to dictionary.reference.com. It's shaped like a pickaxe, but having one end broad instead of pointed. So it's a wide-ended pickaxe is a mattock. And, of course, a pitchfork, you know what that is. And an axe, you know what that is. The NIV doesn't have axe. It has sickles. Actually, the Septuagint, the Hebrew text here for pitchfork has plowshares. So anyway, translation stuff, it doesn't make any difference. The price was 2/3 for plows and mattocks. That takes more sharpening. 1/3 for pitchforks and axes, less sharpening. And how about 1/3 of a shekel for putting a point on an ox goad to make the ox go sharp, so when you stuck the dumb animal, he would feel it. 2/3 of a shekel to sharpen up a plow or a mattock. The NIV note says that's about 8 grams, about a quarter of an ounce. The Holman Christian Study Bible says about a quarter of an ounce of silver. The Hebrew word is only used here. It's called pim, and so people don't know exactly what that means. The KJV ended up translating it sort of weird, which we'll talk about in a minute. So it's 2/3 of a shekel is 1/4 of an ounce of silver, 1/3 of a shekel for the pitchforks and axes. That's about 1/8 of an ounce, about 4 grams instead of 8 grams. And I'm sure you don't really care. Again, why does the author put all this minor detail in here? I don't know what the answer to that is. Now, I said the KJV was going to translate this charge a little bit strange, or the price, verse 21, the price, NASB has the charge, was 2/3 of a shekel. KJV translates it this way, yet they had a file for their plows and mattocks. In other words, they filed it themselves. Well, that doesn't make any sense. They got to go to a blacksmith to sharpen their plows. Then why are they filing it themselves? If they got to go to the blacksmiths in Philistia in verse 20 to sharpen their implements, why in verse 21 are they sharpening their implements themselves with a plow? One more example why the KJV translation just doesn't cut it. It makes the verses contradict each other. Well, Gill's editor, of course, Gill's using the authorized version, the KJV. Gill's editor, Gill doesn't explain this, but Gill's editor does. He says, quote, the word for file in the verse is pim, P-I-M, and maybe pim, I don't know exactly how to pronounce it, and occurs only here in the Hebrew scriptures. It is not used elsewhere in other Hebrew writings. Therefore, the translators of the 1611 authorized version, that's the KJV, had only the root derivation to deduce what the word meant. Literally, it means a file with mouths. A file, F-I-L-E, a file with mouths. However, recently, archaeologists have found a stone inscribed with this word. Also, they found a stone inscribed with the word shekel. Hence, they deduced that the word was really a weight of measure equal to about 1/3 of a shekel. Newer translations usually translate this as the charge was 1/3 of a shekel, hence removing the obvious contradiction between this verse and the preceding one. Folks, you should tell this to your local KJV-only advocate. It is not the only best translation out there. Now, in verse 22, we have a problem. How did the Israelites win their earlier battles with the Philistines if they didn't have sword or spear? Remember, they beat the Philistines at Mizpah a couple chapters ago, chapter 7, and then they beat the Ammonites in chapter 11. How did they do it? The answer to that is they used bows and arrows and slings. They just didn't use swords. But now, coming up against Michmash, they had a problem because they would be coming into a close fight. They needed swords and spears for a close fight. Bows and arrows and slings would not help them here. So they got a problem. Another question arises, well, why didn't Benjamin under Saul despoil Philistia at Mizpah and Ammon at Jabesh-Gilead when they won those two battles? Why didn't they take all the weapons that were available then? Well, an answer to that is the Benjamites only used bows and arrows and slings. They didn't think they needed the swords and spears, and so they didn't take them. And now they need them. The reason we know they need them is because the verse right here brings it up, showing that it's obviously a problem. We go now to the last verse in this chapter. We'll finish this audio, 1 Samuel 13:23. And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass of Michmash. That's the garrison that was there at Michmash. Went out to the pass. I'm sure that's the pass that leads down into the valley that goes towards Geba. But we'll find out in the next chapter because this verse really should be considered in 1 Samuel 14, at the beginning, when we have the actual battle. This is just the setup for the battle in chapter 13. So, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you stay with me for chapter 14's account of the battle at Michmash. I hope you stay tuned for that, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.